My name's Edith. I'm an alcoholic. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. Where's Halliday? Who's the guy? Damn it. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the ties of mine, because you're mine. I walk the line. I'm sure he'll show me up. My name's Edith. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks to a loving God and sponsorship both ways, steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, people like you. I hadn't had a drink since June 1, 1987, and for that I'm very grateful. I really want to thank the committee for having me come up here. And, you know, what Emily didn't say to you about her was they were in a casino when they were supposed to be picking me up. And this gal with her, the new gal, Diane, had on a T-shirt. She was up, laid up in the photograph, laid up against a slot machine, and her T-shirt said, "What happens in Vegas happened to me in Vegas." So I just wanted to thank the committee for assigning me both of them. They've been pretty stalwart, though, with me, and I appreciate that. And Kelly and some of these gals took me out to Diane for the luncheon, and had a good time. And as I do often in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to tell you one thing about Johnny Cash, though. You know, when I was drinking in Alabama, where I grew up, Decatur, Alabama, when somebody would die, and my friends died, they died of hepatitis C, they died because their liver transplants were unsuccessful, they died because they overdosed, they died from alcoholism, gunshot wounds, self-inflicted, and we always had a big time. We got real drunk at their ending ceremonies, and that's how I coped with grief. I never cried. And then after the service, if there's a religious service, we'd go over to the grave, and we'd get drunk out there. And in sobriety, what I found out was that you had to lean into the pain. And so this guy left me, you know, when I was about 2 or 3 years sober. And I'll tell you about him and my story. But I grieved that loss. And I'd never grieved anything in my lifetime. And when Johnny Cash died, I cried for 2 days. Because I'd grown up listening to Johnny Cash with my daddy and Merle Haggard and Hank Williams and Charlie Pride and all these great country music singers, the Carter family, and I cried and cried. I called my old man and I said, "Daddy, I can't quit crying over Johnny Cash." And so I think it's pretty fitting that you got some cat who's going to come in here and and, you know, ring those tunes out, because, boy, there's nothing I'd rather hear than that. You certainly had a good roundup until now. John and I were in Tennessee, which he reminded me about, so you're fortunate to have his, you know, his company last night and the other speakers. I am confident about their skills and ability to, you know, present their position, and tomorrow I'm sure there's going to be a fine speaker, and then tonight you've got me. So I just ask that you, if you're going to sleep, then you know, go out in the outside of the room, and I won't be deterred. But I've got some friends here who used to live in Omaha, so I wanted to acknowledge them. Here they are on the front row, and Tammy I've known for a long time, so it's always good to see a familiar face. But, you know, wherever I go in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm home. In November, I was in New Delhi, and there's 19 million people in Old Delhi and many millions in New Delhi. And in Old Delhi, you'll be riding on a rickshaw with a water buffalo on one side, and their monkeys are domesticated. They move in and out of people's homes, but no traffic, many traffic, no traffic rules in Old Delhi. And I was in a hotel, and I had, as I do wherever I go, I always get the directory. And I had called Sanjeev, and Sanjeev had, after two or three calls, Sanjeev said, "Well, we'll be around. We'll be around to pick you up." And in India, if you've visited there, you know, of course, everyone has very small cars. Mostly they ride on, most people are traveling on motorcycles. And so Sanjeev had a pretty small, compact car. And he came around to get me. And it's, be grateful for clean air and clean water, because in northern India, you don't have those significant necessaries. And so I often would wear a scarf, but Sanjeev came and he smoked Marlboros, of course. And we got in the car and he drove me all the way to a Hindu country primarily, to a Christian school, where we went to one of the few English-speaking meetings in Delhi, and there was one Hindi man there who only spoke Hindi, and of course me and many other people, but the woman sat between us, and she would tell him, because they conducted the meeting in English, and she translated to him everything that was going on, so that this man, who was clearly a suffering alcoholic, could have the opportunity to gather what the meeting was about. So that has happened to me everywhere I've ever been. I know that when I call Alcoholics Anonymous, there'll be somebody at the other end of the line. I count on it. And that's, I went into a situation in Barbados with my husband, and a police officer had told us about a meeting, and when we pulled up, a police officer came to let us in the gate, and as we were entering, he said, "Well, you have to have clearance." And as we got closer to the facility, he said, "This is the facility for the criminally insane, where we have our Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." I said, "Well, no place I'd rather be than right here in Barbados with the criminally insane, where I belong." In Alcoholics Anonymous, you are a world citizen. I mean, that is what has happened to me. And so if you have a central office here and you are, you know, a part of the structure, when Emily was talking to me about being a general service representative, what a great opportunity you have, whether you're at the, you know, you're serving your group, or you're at the district level, the area assembly level. I've got two delegates that go to one of my home groups, the Saturday morning meeting, but my primary home group is the Mayflower, and we meet at 7:30 on Monday nights at 52nd Miami in Omaha, Nebraska, and I'd welcome you there anytime. We're a little irreverent, so I'm warning you now, but boy, we'd sure love to have you. But having that kind of cohesiveness and structure, and being a part of that structure in that upside down triangle of Alcoholics Anonymous is so, I'm so grateful for anybody who's doing that service work, and the people who put on this particular roundup, because that's what facilitates having us communally meet here and having the great opportunity to meet you. And it extends all the way to India. So there's been, and I was grateful to get to a meeting, because I wasn't with a lot of heavy drinkers, but I was, after a long time in the absence of meetings, I can certainly see that I'm, how maladjusted I really am. I brought one joke, because I'm pretty sorry at telling jokes. And I don't know if you get the grapevine, but I've gotten the grapevine for all my sobriety. So, and I'm a hoarder. So the institutions committee guy always says, "Edith, why don't you give up some of those grapevines? Because I keep them all." And I can hardly give them to him. I don't want to give them away. So I grew up in northern Alabama, right near, not too far from where they distill whiskey up there in Tennessee. And a half-century-old memorandum was found in a firm's filing cabinet. It read, "We've noticed that some of our lawyers are drinking vodka when entertaining clients. Please refrain from doing so. However, you may, of course, drink Tennessee distilled bourbon. We'd prefer that our clients think you're drunk rather than stupid." So I'm not too far from where I was brought up. It's sure a pleasure to be here and hear your voices and be in a place that has heavy air and a little bit of a slow movement. I love it. I love being back in the South, and it's just a real pleasure to me. And where I grew up in northern Alabama, we were right on the Tennessee River, and I grew up swimming. I love to swim. I swam today out in this pool. And my daddy, who was a World War II veteran, was a great swimmer. So we, all of us, my brothers and I, were in the river, in the ocean, in the pool, always. And we had a crummy boat. And as we were growing up, we'd get to take the boat out. That was kind of a privilege. The bad news was we were never trained on how to operate the boat. Further bad news for you, if you were on the river, is I didn't know where the channel was. But so I was going to public school over there in Decatur and having a good time mostly. And, you know, I had a cohesive family. My parents drank, but they started having some trouble as time passed. But, you know, that didn't make me an alcoholic. I was born this way, and I can guarantee you that within that family unit, if there's anybody as Tammy well knows, haven't heard this before, but if there's anybody that was a tornado within the family system, it was me. And I've had to try to do a lot to mend that. But I was a good student, and, you know, it's always painful to have your National Honor Society certificate along with your bail bond certificate over at the in your bedroom. But that's how things were going. I had parents who had taught me right from wrong. They were very different. My father was a descendant of Clarence Darren. He had a pretty strong scientific belief system. My mother's belief system was evangelical. And so they had a lot of arguments, but really just came to the conclusion that they would agree to disagree. And I went to both of their churches, my father Episcopalian, my mother to a Bible church. And I bring this to your attention because my mother took me a few times to some revivals, and I think her hope was that, you know, my life might be different. And it never took. You know, I never got the cure because what I had was going to take something spiritual, because what I had was beyond human aid. You know, Clancy talks about three kinds of people, and I really, I'm so confident of this that I've never wavered in it. I've never wavered in the idea of whether or not my life's unmanageable and I'm powerless over alcohol. But one kind of cat may have a serious event in their life, and that serious event may cause them to stop drinking. You know, my partner in my business, one of them, had some bad experiences when he was in college, and he quit drinking. And, you know, he's 63, I'm 52, but he's been my partner for 17 years, and he doesn't drink anymore. And he never has. I've been to all of his kids' weddings and their children's births and their baptisms, and he doesn't drink because of that those few bad events when he was in college. And then there's another kind of person who may be physically addicted to alcohol, and as they may have some kind of medical oversight and get removed from that daily consumption, then they quit drinking. And then there's somebody like me, somebody like John, and that's somebody who's got a disease and can't quit drinking, and no human power can stop us from drinking, and these events in our life aren't going to stop us from drinking, and it's got to be some kind of intervention. And, you know, my parents probably, they had some resources. They probably would have tried, you know, to have a priest come in and, you know, take me through the process of when they removed the demons from the, but they never did that, although they had me talk to some priests. But that's what I suffer from. I suffer from alcoholism like that. And so the only thing that I know that's worked for me has been Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step was something that I could get up on. And you gave me a plan for living. You know, when I would go to some of these religious institutions with my mama, there was no follow-through as to what would happen. Today, at 25 years sober, I call my sponsor every Sunday at 7 p.m. You know why? Because I still got to be accountable. You know why? Because I've been praying every day and every night for a guy that I want to kill, that I want to die, because that's how impaired I am in my the perception that I have about things. And so I've been praying for him, just like it speaks to in the book on 551. You know, I have the privilege of practicing a profession, and he's for 10 years I've been his adversary in that profession, and it never stops. And he's relentless. And I thought about hiring a private investigator, which I have in my business. And I started thinking these things about how can I lead to his demise. And so I've been praying just like it talks about on 552 for this cat. If you have a resentment, you want to be free of it. If you'll pray for the person or the thing that you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, and their happiness, and you will be free. Even if you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. So, that's not the best report I could give you after 25 years of sobriety. But I can tell you that every day I thank God for the freedom from alcoholism. And every day to have nobody on my no-call list. I don't want anybody on my no-call list. I don't want anybody to walk in a room that I'm ashamed to see face to face. And that's why when we talk about freedom from bondage, that's the gig here. That's what you're going to get. And it doesn't matter if you're incarcerated like the men and women that I see on Monday night. It doesn't matter whether you're in that actual physical bricks and mortar prison. What we're talking about is getting free from the bondage of self. We are the architects of our own prison. We create it, and Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps and the grace that we get so freely is what breaks us out of those handcuffs. I was in Yakima, Washington, about 2 years ago, and there's this kid on the stage with me, and he's about 22, and he's done all the marketing, and there's a lot of people at this convention, and it was the theme was freedom from bondage, and he had done all these t-shirts and about 1,000 coffee cups, and they all said 22nd 22th Yakima Roundup. And I said, I'm taking home about 10 of these because they're the only 22nd anniversary of the Yakima Roundup. Anyway, but it has the handcuffs getting broken open. You know, I had a guy tell me one time, you are mentally ill, Edith, and I cannot live with you. I can't live with you. He said, you need to go to, you need some help. And you know what I said to him? I said, if you can handcuff me here. Now, that sounds a little sadomasochistic. It's not, okay? It doesn't have anything to do with that. I said, if you can get me some handcuffs and just handcuff me here, I know I won't go out and drink and do what I usually do. And that's how far I'd gone to manage my alcoholism. I always had two and on, second on, my watch pocket and my Levi's, because I knew when I started drinking, I wouldn't know where I'd end up, and it was a good thing to have those, because then I'd probably go to sleep. I had a boyfriend when I was in high school who owned some property, and he could help me get out of jail, because my father had stopped being of assistance in that way. And I had, I knew a lawyer, and the guys that I ran with, they all knew lawyers because we were all, you know, they were criminals. And so I had good referential information about how to manage alcoholism, I thought. And what happened is it was a big failure. So I was growing up in Alabama as I was speaking to, and I had a good time on the river and was always drinking on the river. My parents had a big liquor cabinet because we were in that dry county. And so I would take liquor from my parents. They both drank quite a bit, and take liquor out of there and watch them. And I liked what it did for me. You know, liquor gave me everything I didn't have, which was self-confidence, unity, peace. I think every alcoholic here wants to be in unity. That's what we look for all our lives, and we never have it until we get here. I wanted to be in unity, and I never was. I was always segregated and outside. I didn't understand it. I fought it, and alcohol became my greatest elixir, and I loved it. I loved drinking Jim Beam. I loved listening to Johnny Cash. I loved being down at the River Club in Triana where there wasn't any flooring, and they never played Hank Williams Jr. And I could wear my bikini, and you didn't have to get dressed, and they didn't close, and you didn't have to wash your hair. And the guys that I ran with had guns, and they'd be asleep, and they all had nicknames, and I won't go into those because some of them might listen to this tape. But, you know, but for an exorcism, my parents did try everything. They did. And so as time passed, if you were watching me in a helicopter, you would have probably predicted that these things are going to happen to Edith. You know, she's going to have trouble in high school. She's going to be arrested. She's going to get removed from her household. And all those things happened. But we'd go out on the river because I could drive the boat before I could drive the car. And you'd get out in the river. And we'd go down to Triana to the bootlegger, and Marveline would be down there, and you'd just knock any time, day or night. This guy's already yawning here in the back. You'd get out there day or night. Marveline would come out, give you a case of Schlitz for $6, okay? If you just got in here, you'd probably been buying one beer for $6. Oh, baby, I buy my friends beers when I go back to Alabama and all my friends from high school. And you buy four of them a beer, and that's, you know, $25. And then they drink these Jaeger bombs. Wow. After that, it's time for me to go home. I always have a car and my own transportation. But I don't tell anybody about what they should be doing because that's none of my affair. If somebody comes to me and asks me about alcoholism, and they want some help, then I'm sure willing to give it to them. We're often out on the river, and we're often getting the you know, the propeller repaired. The guy would say, Edith, nobody comes in here with a propeller for repair as often as you. You're my best customer. And people would be arrested from behind my boat for reckless skiing. The Coast Guard of, if there, yeah, the Coast Guard, I guess he was. The Coast Guard knew where our boathouse was because we were always drunk. And we had a real crummy boathouse. It was kind of sinking into the, sinking down into the river. It looked like Saigon. All. But it was a good time for me. And pretty unbridled. You know, there I was never arrested and removed from the boat. So, but we would get ticketed and get in trouble. And this went on through my high school years. I'd go to high school and I'd do well when I was there. And then at night, I'd go out drinking all up into Huntsville, go to the Plush Horse, which was a disco club. I mean, that's how old I am. I'm 52. And, you know, Donna Summer was pretty famous. And we wore jumpsuits and danced, you know. Anyway, I loved it. And then I'd go to Tennessee, too, because they had a younger drinking age, and we had false IDs, and I loved drinking. And so I'd go to school, and outside our school, the Decatur High School, we had two parking lots. One was where the all the athletes went, and the other one was the gravel parking lot, and that's where people who smoked pot and drank before school went, and that's where I went. And I had a Pontiac Bonneville. That's an important fact. I'll tell you why, because when I was just finishing high school, I'd been drinking all day, Jane and I, my best Confederate, and we'd been to the Plush Horse, and we were on our way home and got out of her Volkswagen Rabbit and got into my Pontiac Bonneville, told my parents I was home, left out the back door quietly, got in the Pontiac Bonneville, and we were on a dirt road, country road, going out to Trinity where she lived, and we were in a train accident, or caught my car. So train was coming along the track, and we caught the side of it, and it, you know, the car was like an accordion, and then it fell off into a ravine, and the windshield went through my throat, and Jane was thrown from the car. And the bad news for Jane was that she'd ever gotten in a car with me, because Jane had already been in a bad car accident, head-on collision, drinking, and she'd been in a body cast for about 8 to 9 months in advance of this accident. And we would take her to parties in the back of a truck, like that. The good news that I have to report is Jane's alive, and she didn't have any complications that were serious from that accident, but I could have certainly caused the death of someone, as has happened to some of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, we leave a lot of bullet holes in the universe in that, you know, the skirt. And that's what 8 and 9, those particular steps are for. And, man, I'm still doing that work. You know, I just sent a guy a check. I had an amends to make, and if you've ever heard the spiritual life is not a theory like the book talks about, man, is that true. You know, sometimes I can think, you can meditate, you can pray, but I'm really busy, okay? The spiritual life is not a theory. What a concept. How often do I have to be reminded of that? So I've got, Sandy Beach has a tape with that exact title, if you've ever heard it, and he says, there will be times when these clouds come above your head, just like Charlie Brown's teacher's words, and you'll be reminded that there is someone you haven't done justice towards. And so this guy kept coming up, coming up, coming up, and you know what I thought? Hey, you were at Auburn University with me? That's right, War Eagle, baby. You were at the university with me. you made a bad choice to get into a deal with me. You lost a lot of money. That's your problem, okay? Because what we were doing was illegal anyway. And I mean, I had for years looked at this transaction with that kind of distortion, wrong perception. And so as it keeps coming up to me, what else is happening in my landscape? Let's see, my father and I, who I'm visiting in Alabama, happened to sit by this guy's father in a at a luncheon. His brother happens to be in the choir and comes and sits by me when I go to church with my father. It's like, I don't want to see any of this guy's family members. I gave this guy some serious reputation problems. He comes to Auburn, good student from my high school, and then starts spending time over at my house. And my house was circling the drain. And if you came over where I lived at Auburn University, you only had one thing in mind, and that's drinking and doing drugs. And I really gave this guy an introduction into a life that caused him some real hardship. And so we'd done this deal, and I kept thinking about it. And, you know, my sponsor said, you got to find him. Well, I found him. You know, I made the effort. I found him. I called him. I told him that I needed to make amends to him. And he was receptive to it. And we had a discussion, and he's got a serious disease, and he's, you know, because of some of the things he and I used to do together, a lot of people I know have serious diseases, but he was receptive to my amends. I'm telling you that story because that was in my 24th year of sobriety, and this is an event that had happened over 30 years ago. And so now when I see his father, now when I see his brother, now if I see him, I can look him in the eye. He's not on my no-call list. I don't have any shame about that. And that's what that kind of ongoing work, sowing those fertile seeds is what is, you know, a critical event to me, because I can't afford to have anybody on my no-call list. You know, there's still times today when I think drinking looks like a good idea, and a coma looks like a better idea, okay? So I don't think about having a couple of drinks. It's get me to a coma, because that's where I like to go. I like to get drunk. I always had the bottle with me. And I don't know if you remember Big Jim Folsom, who ran for governor down in Alabama. This gentleman does. But my granddaddy used to say, who I never met, but my daddy would tell me this story, that Big Jim he'd take the cork off of the whatever he was drinking, H&H, and then spit it out, because he knew he'd take that bottle all night. And then, of course, the bad news for him was when he was running for governor, he was, of course, television was a new event. This is in the 50s, and he was televised, and he came up, and he'd been drinking, sadly, even though he had an entourage that was supposed to keep him from it, and he forgot his children's names as they came out on the podium. Anyway, that's what I do. I live out loud when I'm drinking. You know, everything's exposed, and that's truly figuratively and true. So I'm getting arrested in high school, and you know, in Alabama they take your tags off your car, impound your tags. And when I got to the Midwest, by way of a sentence and a supervised living quarters order and et cetera, and got arrested there, they don't come and get your tags. So I thought, well, this is pretty handy. They hadn't figured out how, you know, that this was important. And I just kept driving. And this is in 1987, you know, and I had a sponsor then. It was my first year of sobriety. And she said, I thought you didn't have a driver's license. I said, yeah, I don't. But, you know, nobody here understood that they could come get my tags. And my probation officer isn't going to know any better. And my sponsor said, yeah, you know the better. You know, it is a program of honesty. There's going to be a gal who's going to come up to you that you're going to sponsor, and she's going to say she doesn't have a driver's license, and you're going to have to tell her to ride the bus. You're going to have to tell her to walk. You're going to have to tell her to call somebody and get to the meeting. That's the way it is, Edith. She was absolute about honesty, period, transparency, period. And that served me very well, having that type of sponsorship early in sobriety. She really didn't care how I interpreted the book. She just said, we're going to work the steps. We're going to go through the book. And we did. And she was committed to that. You know, today in my house on Sundays when I'm home, we have every noon, we have a big book study. First we went through all the steps and the 12 and 12. Then we went through the traditions and the 12 and 12. And then we got through the book. Now we're on the book. But I can't tell you what's going to happen at that table. Because it is supernatural what happens at that table. Sometimes there'll be a gal who got out of prison at one end of the table and one going to prison at the other end of the table. And they start talking to each other about, you know, what their outcome's going to be and how the long view could be staying sober through your jail sentence or your prison sentence or your federal prison sentence. And I never know what's going to happen at that table. But it is a privilege and an honor to be at that table Sunday after Sunday. It's a privilege and an honor to have a seat in my home group. And you know what I do after that home group? Clean up, because I want to be a big shot. You know, I want to be in the front line, okay? I don't want to be in the back quietly doing the work that gets the meeting set up or cleaned up. But what I usually need to be doing is walking in the men's restroom on some guy, which happens once in a while, and cleaning up the restrooms and cleaning up the church where we meet. That's a good job for me. My home group is a safe place, and what's said there stays there. Most people are confidential there, and I can say that with some security. But And as you can see, this is not a very linear talk. I had one guy come up to me one time, and he said, I couldn't quite follow you, but I did understand that you had a pinball machine mentality. Anyway, so I'm in Alabama. I'm getting out of high school, and my father, after this car accident, I was in the hospital for a long time. Not a long time, but for weeks. I had to have respiratory therapy so I could breathe and talk again. And I was drinking in the hospital. I had people bringing me beer up to the hospital. And I never had any idea. If you had come to me and said, Edith, here's the logical progression of what's going on in your life, and drinking seems to be the taproot of all this trouble, I had no idea like that. I just thought that I had, you know, some serious events had intervened to cause me a great deal of trouble because of some, you know, bad consequences that were not going to be replicated. I never got the idea that every time I started drinking, one was too many and a million wasn't enough. And my father asked me to leave the house because he got it. You know, he was older than my mother. He was a disciplinarian. He had been to World War II. My mother would cry at my feet. And by this time, I was running with some guys. And back then, you could go in through the ceiling of pharmacies. Today, things are a little more secure, but that's the way things were going back then. And my daddy said to me a couple of things. One, you and Scott and Hicks are going to be dead or in jail before you're 21. And, you know, I didn't understand the import of how, and I was 17, of my father's words, of how confident he was about that outcome. Until I was about 10 years sober and my father's second wife had died. And he had some estate planning work for the benefit of my stepbrothers and sisters. And he said, would you look at this? And I said, yeah, your insurance poor. Why do you have all these life insurance policies? And he said, well, those all aren't on my life. Three of them are on your life. So, and he said, but I'm glad I lost that bet. I said, me too, Daddy. And so he said that to me, and it came true. You know, Scott went to prison, Hicks is dead, and I came very close to doing prison time, once with them and another time by some of my own actions. And my father got it. He would go to the pawn shop, and when I'd take jewelry that I had stolen, he would tell the pawn shop owner, call me, I'm going to buy it back. If I had my father's checks from his business and I was trying to secure funds, he'd tell the banker, don't cash any checks that Edith brings in. If I'd been gone for a couple of days, he'd tell the guys that worked for him, go get a tow truck and go find Edith's car. I had a Lincoln, after the Pontiac Bonneville, I had a Lincoln Marquis. Go find the Lincoln Marquis, pick it up, tow it to the fenced-in gas station, one of Daddy's stations, and fenced-in, tow it there. That's how he did it. My mother, on the other hand, would cry at my feet, beg me, prayed for me. I'm sure my mother's prayers kept me alive a little longer. But I had a, just as I said, a predictable outcome. Not to me. I kept thinking that things were going to change. And then as time passed, I remember sitting in a jail cell up in where I live, Morgan County. I'd been arrested on the 4th of July, as I recall, and I had on a bikini and I had a T-shirt on that said, disco sucks, and on the back, marijuana is nature's way of getting high. And that's what I went to my arraignment in. And the reason I'm telling you that story is because Judge Straub, who was the particular judge in the county where I lived, sat by my father every Sunday in the Episcopalian church because both of their mothers had memorial windows together. And that's the kind of position that I put my parents in every day of their upbringing of me. I dishonored them every day, day after day after day. And that's pretty hard to repair. But you showed me the best way that I could to repair it. So I went and lived at Jane's house, and we started working on a dairy farm with one of her stepfathers. And hell, that was a hard, excuse my coarse language, that was the hardest work I'd ever done. I couldn't believe it. I could barely carry the milk buckets between my feet. And I went to back to my father, and I said, would you consider allowing me to go to school? Because he knew that I would, you know, that I had at least the competency to go to college. And he said, all right. And I got down to Auburn University, and I went there because a guy I'd been seeing was going there. You know, today these young people, my son included, make some trips to colleges and give a lot of consideration to their ACT scores. And I took the test after I'd been up all night, and then I went to Auburn because they let me in, okay? So that's about how that went. But no one would take, I didn't have a car then. I was, because my license was impounded. And the only guy that would pick me up was the garbage man, the city garbage man in Opelika. And he'd drive me into Auburn. And I'd go to school, and I was drinking every day, drinking gin. And I, as time passed, as you would have predicted, I didn't go to school. And as time passed, as you would have predicted likewise, I had a couple of police officers who knew me pretty well. One of them came over to my house, and he said, Edith, you know, I've been watching you, and I know what you're doing, because I was a criminal. And he said, I know that Scott was here. I know that, you know, I know what he was doing, and we had him extradited. And I said, yeah, I know you did. I know you had him extradited back to Florida, and you can get out of my house. And I didn't say it with that kind of courtesy. I told him to leave with some profanity. I didn't even have the courtesy to get dressed. I had on a bathrobe. Well, he left, and before he left, he said, I'll do anything to help you. He was dating a gal from my hometown. He wanted to help me. He knew I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. He said, I'll do anything to help you, but you need some help. He said, don't think that it's going unsurveilled. And I told him to get out of my house, and he came back. He came back on my birthday. You know, your birthday starts about a week in advance. Yeah. Well, that's how mine had started. And they came in with a no-knock warrant, and they put everybody on the ground with a shotgun to their head. And I thought the best course for me would be to go out the back window. It was a long drop, though, about 15 feet. And I heard him from the back, and he said, "Edith, we got the house surrounded. Get inside and get dressed." That was a bad habit I had of traveling in my bathrobe because I didn't have time to get dressed. I went to school at Auburn University, and I lived at 1313A Opelika Highway. I can tell you that because I saw it on a few search warrants, and I remember it. But anyway, I lived about 40 feet from a bar called Harry's. And Harry's was the kind of joint I liked to drink in. And, you know, I lived with a guy who's now an engineer with NASA. Unbelievably, he lived with me. But he was a good cat. And Tim and I would go down to Harry's. He was a very good pool player. And Harry's served beer and pig's feet. And it stayed open till the sun rose. And sometimes I didn't have time to get dressed. And I'd go down there in my bathrobe and drink at Harry's. Harry's had a women's urinal wall that said, "Don't throw any toothpicks in the urinal because crabs can pole vault." One time I was talking in Maryland, and they gave me this beautiful big pewter crab, and I said, "Oh, I can't thank you enough." I can't tell you what this means to me. Have this in my house and be free of crabs. But anyway, this was more serious than these other events, and I later had a trial, and my father came, and I got 5 years in Juliet Tutwiler prison in Tuskegee, Alabama, and what transpired right before that was the police officers that arrested me wanted me to help them out, and rather than do that, because you know you got the code of the street, I left town, and I was living out in the woods with a couple of guys who drank like I did, and I was pretty sick by then. And my father came down to Auburn because this had been newsworthy all over the state, and not just me, but other people that they'd gone in with these no-knock warrants. And my father paid people, and he found me out in the woods with these cats that I was living with. He paid people to find me. And he came to this house. It was an old cabin where we were. And this wasn't, I mean, there's no other residential place out there but this place. And he had a gun, and my brother had a gun, and they both had handcuffs. And my father said to these guys, came to the door, and he said, "You know, I'm armed, and all I want is my daughter. And if you'll give her up, we won't have any trouble. But I'm armed, and my son's armed. And if we got to have some trouble, we'll have it." And, of course, these guys, being my stalwart allies, they pushed me right out the door. My parents drugged me. My mother, by this time, had been in a number of hospitals because she was an alcoholic. And my father and mother gave me Seroquel, which my mother was taking, drugged me, and took me to a mental hospital and locked me in there. And I was locked up in there for a few months. One thing I knew while I was there is that I wasn't going to drop my anchor there. I didn't want to stay there. I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew I didn't want to stay in the mental health care system residentially. And we did a lot of leather work. And some nice guy in Colorado gave me this beautiful book cover, and I, in front of many people, said, "You know, I tried to make something just like that up at the Parthenon Pavilion in the mental hospital." And I think he took offense to it, but it's really beautiful, and I've kept this and love it. But we were doing leather. We were making moccasins, and I knew at that moment, this isn't something else. There's something else that's going to be of assistance to me. I don't know what it is. If you've ever played volleyball when you're up there in the mental hospital, it's a long game because, you know, sometimes you got to run under the net and volley your own ball back. I got out of there. I went to my trial, and my father had played his last card for me. He'd gotten a gentleman who'd been to Korea with the judge to speak to the judge, and I got 5 years, and it was suspended. And my daddy got on a plane that day and said, "Don't ever come back to our house. Don't ever call your mother, your great aunt, or your grandmother, because I'm instructing all of them not to give you anything. You've been a tornado through our household, and you can't be a part of our lives anymore. And I love you." And my daddy got on a plane and left. And I knew he meant it. I had to go into supervised living quarters in Sioux City, Iowa. I didn't even know where this was. Iowa from Idaho. I had to get out the atlas and look it up. And you know what happened to me there is I had a stint of staying sober. I went to meetings. I was required to, and I had to make these reports. But when I was released about a year later, I moved in with a guy who I had been working for. And I'm not proud to tell you this, but I compromise myself often. This guy got me an air conditioner. I'd been living in Section 8 housing, and he bought me an air conditioner while I was up there. And I lived on the fourth floor, and it was steaming hot in the summer times. But, I was a whore for an air conditioner. And that's just the way it was. I was the kind of girl who got on a bus with a country music band, drinking, and I would have been the only gal on the bus. And then I see this movie screen come down, and it's a hardcore porn movie. And if you're putting yourself in those kind of positions, you can only know that the outcome's going to be damaging. And it's going to be damaging to many people, but it was something that I did a lot. I would end up in locales, and I didn't know the street signs because I didn't know how I got there, and I didn't know the town I was in. And so after I'd gotten out of these living quarters, I was moved in with this man, lived in Section 8 housing, then moved in with this guy, and I went over to a bar one night next door to where we lived called the Dodge Inn. And I had one white Russian, and then I had seven more. And things took off just like they always had. And so what ended up happening is I was in Omaha, Nebraska, because I'd been thrown out of a couple of places. And a guy in AA, gave me a place to live. And I was in another car accident. And up at the hospital, they took my blood. I was on a suspended sentence in Alabama and going to jail in Nebraska. And the guy, judge said, "How'd your BAC count get that high at 8 in the morning?" I didn't have an explanation. But I went to jail, and they put me out on house arrest. And my probation officer said, "Edith, you're an alcoholic. You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to go every, three times a week. And you're going to have these," I had an ankle bracelet. And then next thing that happened was I kept having all this trouble in my esophagus. And I go up to the University of Nebraska Medical Center because you can bet a gal like me, living the life I've lived, unemployable but working a little bit, had no insurance. And the doctor comes out and he says, "No frothy emotional appeal at all." He said, "You're under 30 and you're an alcoholic." He said, "I've read your medical file." He said, "I don't even think I need to explain to you what's going to be your outcome." He said, "But if you want me to help you with this esophageal trouble and the other trouble that you have," I had another related disease. He said, you are going to have to quit drinking. And he said, and I want that contract to be right now. Can you make that contract? And I said, I don't know. But I knew that moment, that day on June 1, 1987, that I was an alcoholic. And everything that doctor told me, I consumed. And if you have that chance, when that moment of desperate circumstances intervened with the opportunity, that will be the most sacred opportunity that you're ever presented, and I got it. My mother didn't get it. She's dead from drinking. My cousin didn't get it. He's dead from drinking. My mother's sister, dead from an accident from drinking. I got a whole line of people who went to church, who read the Bible more than me, who had people praying for them, who said, I'm going to get released from alcoholism. And they're dead. And I'm not saying that doesn't work for people. I'm just saying for me, it had to come down to pick and shovel work. Working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was the only solution for me. Because the life I was living, you drink too, baby. That's how I looked at it. I couldn't get up in the morning and not drink because I had left so much wreckage behind me the night before and 10 years before and 15 years before. And so the landscape for me could only be show a trajectory up. And I started going to AA because my probation officer was requiring it of me. And this woman called me out at the 48th Street Club, where I would go every day because I didn't know in Omaha, Nebraska, that there were, at that point in time, probably 400 other meetings. But I went to this clubhouse also because I could walk there and I didn't have any transportation. And she called me out and said, Edith, I'm going to be your sponsor. My name's, she called me Ethel, actually, at the first meeting. I'd been going, I'd come in late, I'd leave early, I didn't want to have to engage with you because I didn't want to know you because I didn't want the responsibilities that I thought you were going to put on me. And if I knew you as little as I knew most of the other people then that I had engaged with, then I wouldn't have to be responsible to you. I wouldn't have to be friends with you. I wouldn't have to be a good employee. I wouldn't have to show up on time because I never did any of that. I didn't know how to do any of that. And that's what you taught me. So Pamela says, Ethel, come on up. I walked up there and I said, my name's Edith. I'm an alcoholic. And that woman became my sponsor and worked the steps with me and read the book. And we did 12-step calls. And I learned a great deal from her. I've had her, two other women, and my sponsor now. So four women have sponsored me. Two of them moved out of town, and one had sadly suffered from dementia. So I have a sponsor today that I call every week, and she sees me at a meeting every week, and she knows that looking in my eyes what the story is. And I tell her the truth. I'm accountable to her. And then I have women that I sponsor, and they talk to me. And they, we work the steps together and we go through the book. And some of them come to over in my house at noon. You know, I had I told you a little bit about Johnny Cash, but I had a guy that I met early in sobriety. And I was going to I had my little job, you know, didn't have a car, rode the bus to our big Christmas party for the job, newly sober, one good dress, my mama's. Orange silk, had a few stains on it. Hopefully you didn't notice them. Got out in the rain to go to the Christmas party. Never been to a party sober. I look across the room, a lot of people, very jovial, having a good time. And there's one cat, and he went to the meeting. He went to one of the meetings I went to. I looked over there, and he said, you look beautiful. You look beautiful to me. That's what he said with his lips. I didn't look beautiful. I looked like like I'd been drowned. Why am I telling you that story? One kind word. One kind word to that new person in that meeting. One kind word to the guy in the penitentiary. When I go into the penitentiary in Lincoln, Nebraska, the guy says, you want protection, Edith? No. Why? Because I belong there. That's where... You know, we've got a Omaha work release center called OCC in Omaha. And then my husband's parents belong to the Omaha Country Club, OCC. Okay? I always say, I'm at home at OCC, baby. And you know which one. So what do I know when I'm in the penitentiary? What do people want? One kind touch, one kind word. They want to be in unity. They want unity. That's what we want as alcoholics. And so so as I'm going through this party that I'm not sure how to conduct myself, this guy has given me the one kind word, and I make it through it. I always know, take my own transportation or have a way to get home and go after I'm spiritually fit and be of service. I know those things about where I'm going, okay, if there's going to be drinking there. Well, the rest of the story is I moved in with this guy, okay? No time. So But what I wanted to tell you about him, because he's a good cat. And we lived together, and finally he said, you know, live without me. Why? Because I took people hostage. I either don't have any time for you, or I've got to oversee every move you make, and you got to understand what a prize I am. And I thought, when he said live without me, I thought if I can get him in a room for a while and tell him what a mistake he's made, he'll understand. He does not understand the scope of this. And I called him. I went to his house. I talked to everybody I knew about him. And my sponsor said, you can't conduct yourself that way. This is third step work right now. Release it. He's giving you boundaries. He doesn't want to see you. You're a stalker. And I said the third step prayer morning, noon, and night. I lost 15 pounds. I cried every day for 2 or 3 months. I went to school and could barely get there. By this time, I'd gotten admitted into school. And my friend would say, make your universe this small, Edith, and just take these things very minimally. Make your universe 1 hour. Stay sober for 1 hour and then call someone. Stay sober for 2 hours. Do your homework. Go to your class. And I had to make my universe that small to stay sober. I thought I could not grieve and stay sober. I'd never done it before. I'd never been in that kind of pain. Now, I've had a lot of things happen to me since then. But that grief, living through that, was a great lesson for me. The guy, my old boyfriend, took up with a gal, and she was Middle Eastern, just beautiful. And all I could think about is the two of them having some kind of unusual sexual positions over at his house. And then she shows up at Alcoholics Anonymous. At my home group. You know what I wanted to tell her? I won't repeat from the podium. You know what my sponsor said? Principles before personalities. Nobody cares what you think about her. If she has a desire to stop drinking, she has a seat in the room. You're to treat her with respect and kindness like every other newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the kind of sponsorship I need because I'm a bonehead. And you know, that gal, and I prayed for that woman just like I've been praying for this guy every day for a year. She and I ended up in a room together, and it's right when the Shah had left Tehran, and it was a pretty serious, events, world events were going on in her family that affected her family. And I out of my mouth came, I hope your family is safe. And that I hope they have security in wherever they're navigating to. I don't know where that came from except some kind of a force beyond my control. Because it didn't come from me. And that guy and I are still friends. I had to go and make amends to my family. And my father and I became the best of friends. Because I went home when I told him I'd come home. And I told him the truth. When my father saw me back in Decatur, he knew that I went to meetings at the Princess Theater. So one night I was up there, and my daddy rode his bike around when he was alive, and he got his bikes from the police auction. And that means that if your bike was stolen, my father would go buy us bikes from the stolen bikes, and then he'd write our names on them with a big magic marker like they were going to be stolen again. And his name was Shine, and he was a good cat, and he'd ride his dog around with him in the bike. And I'm leaving the meeting, and this guy says, "Hey, Shine was up here." And I said, "Doggone, wonder why." And he said, "I don't know, but he just rode off." And I got in the car that I'd driven, which was my father's car, and there were all these peppermints on the windshield. Well, I knew Shine had been up there because Shine didn't know anybody in Cartersville, Georgia, who's in Alcoholics Anonymous. But he knew his daughter was at that meeting on that night where she said she'd be, and she hadn't been to jail in the last 15 years back then. He was thanking you for helping me stay sober. This past couple of months, my father had to go on to dialysis, and I started flying home and going back and forth there and making, you know, decisions with my brothers. And what transpired was my father lost his ability to communicate, and I didn't know whether he wanted a feeding tube anymore, whether or not he wanted suction in out of his mouth, but I, with my brothers, decided, you know, we'd take him home on hospice. And only because you'd taught me how to be quiet, and along with the Lakota Indians, because when I first got sober, I went to the Sweat Lodge, and I learned about being contemplative and being silent, because I didn't have any of those disciplines when I came to you. So I knew that, and I could sit with my father day after day in silence, and as he was going over to the other side, and he couldn't talk to me, and I said a great deal to him and sang to him and was peaceful with him. And my brothers were a little disturbed by this because hospice came in and brought me fentanyl and morphine and lorazepam, and they both said, "Listen, she's an alcoholic and a drug addict. What are you giving her all this for?" And they gave it to me because I was there, because I could be there, because I was fortunate enough to have partners who were covering me at my business, and I could be there with my daddy and just stay until he went over the other side. And that's only because of you that I learned about being committed and devoted and looking at the outcomes for other people, and how can I look at their emotional well-being, and how can I service that. That's what you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people carried my water while I was at home and flying back and forth, and many of them were in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my father, I carry a picture around of him. It's got a broken frame now, but I know he's with me, and I know that he's grateful that I'm sober. I went back to school in sobriety, and I'll close with this story. I didn't have a good history behind me, but the Jesuits, you know, they're forgiving guys, boy. They gave me a second chance. When I got finished with professional school, I went to sign up to take the exam, which takes 2 days, and they said, "You can't take the exam because we've read your records." So I'd spent about 80 G's in 3 years of education. And you want to talk about being irreverent? Boy, I was. I was irreverent with God. I called some people. I cussed a lot. I was devastated. I cried. And my sponsor said, "You know, why don't you see if there's an appeal process?" I got some of my professors, and they joined me in asking that they reconsider, and they did. And so I told that committee the same thing that I told the Board of Pardons and Paroles in Alabama when I went before them. And that was, I can't make any predictions about the future, but I can tell you, if I remain in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsored with sponsees, doing service work, working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I think I can tell you that I'll be of good service to your profession. And I think that if you'll give me the pardon, speaking directly to the Board of Pardons and Paroles, then you'll consider me to be a citizen worthy of that pardon. Now, I don't have that pardon certificate in my law office, but I'm proud of it. The Board of Pardons and Paroles pardoned me in 1991, and that same year I was given a law degree to practice law in the state of Nebraska. That's not to tell you that what you're doing is gonna, you know, you may not get educated in Alcoholics Anonymous. You may be a parent. You may be whatever you're doing. All I'm telling you is that the journey of a million miles starts with the very first step. And you gotta take that step and go live your wild, precious life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for your time and consideration. Godspeed.